Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Our country is becoming more racially and ethnically diverse, and according to the Pew Research Center, so are religious groups. Yet the degree of diversity varies greatly among the religious groups. Pew Research data from 2014 found that diversity was greatest in Seventh-day Adventist, Muslim, and Jehovah's Witness groups, while Lutheran, Methodist, and National Baptist Convention were among the least diverse. What is the importance of diversity in faith communities, and how can we make congregations more welcoming, especially in a region like ours that is racially homogenous and geographically isolated? Joining us in studio is Reverend Kristen Harper. She's pastor of the Unitarian Church of Barnstable. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Reverend Will Mebben, who is from the St. Barnabas Church.
Welcome. Good morning, Mindy.
And Reverend Deb Warner from the Church of the Messiah here in Woods Hole.
Hi. Good morning.
And on the phone, Reverend Ken Campbell, convener of Nauset Interfaith Association. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you all.
So, Ken, let's start with you. Before we dive into some of these topics, would you remind us of the mission of the Nauset Interfaith Association and some of the congregations that are members of that coalition?
Sure. Nauset Interfaith is an association of 21 congregations in the eight towns of the Lower Nauta Cape. And actually, it originally was simply an Orleans clergy group. But particularly in 2001... It moved to become an interfaith group, and then later decided it should be lay voices too, not just clerics. So it has expanded over the years, and as I said, now has 21 members. And the focus of the group, besides supporting each other and learning from each tradition, is, and I can just quote our mission statement, to provide mutual support and encouragement to each other and to work together for the common good of our wider community, especially with the poor, the oppressed, and the marginalized. Mm.
Are there any predominantly Black or Latino churches that are part of the coalition?
There are not, because there are none in our area. Interestingly enough, we do have a number of the clergy of our members are from minority traditions. We have 3 African American, 2 Chinese American, 1 from India, Indian American, 1 Korean American. So the clergy do have more of a variety than is in our native population here.
Yeah.
And our congregations also include Muslim representatives, and the Jewish congregation here is well represented, as well as a number of Unitarians and others.
Yeah. Now, Kristen, you were one of the first Black women in the Unitarian Church to pastor a predominantly white congregation. So how did the congregation welcome you?
They welcomed me with open arms. They were very happy to have me and interested in knowing what it would be like to have a Black pastor. And they had some questions about where I came from and what I believed. And being raised Unitarian Universalist was not an issue for them, because I was. And so they really just were welcoming and open.
Mm. Did you address the racial difference between you and the congregation when you first got there?
No, I didn't. Mm-hmm. It was brought up in little, you know, pieces where people asked me if I was from the city, because I'm from Harvard, Massachusetts, and so people, I think, thought that was Cambridge. but other than that, it wasn't raised at all at the beginning.
Yeah. Right, well, how long have you been pastor at St. Barnabas, and how diverse is your congregation?
I've been there for just over a year. I arrived in September of last year. And we have very little diversity. But in following your question to Kristen, I would say the congregation was very intentional about wanting a person of color as their ninth rector. And that came as a surprise to me. And I did raise the issue during our interview process. I was very open about that. And I remember saying to them, "You all do know I'm Black, right?" And I got that kind of reaction. And I said, "But we need to talk about that, because I want to make sure you really are ready for this black person, at least, to be a part of the community.
Yeah, and you, I'm sure you had. You said you reached off the air. You said you reached out to Kristen when you were thinking about taking the job here. So you had to be a little bit concerned, right?
I was definitely concerned. Yes, and I did call Kristen to try to get some intel on how she thought the people on the Cape would be accepting of having a black person as a spiritual leader.
Yeah. So do, as people of color, do you find you're often in the position of having to bring diversity and inclusion to the attention of the white people in your congregation? And is it a role that you embrace?
It is not a role I embrace, but it is something that I have to do. Because it comes up almost every day in my life, in the lives of people of color who come into our congregations. And in just casual conversation, lots of people relate to me because I'm black, as a black person. And instead of as a pastor, they see it as an opening to tell stories about the black people they know, the horror stories that they've, you know, seen or mistakes they've made.
Mm. What about you, Will?
Well, I, again, a little different than Kristen. I am pretty upfront and out front about having conversations and preaching about black, so-called black issues, Black Lives Matter, and what have you. And that has been received very well by the majority of the congregation, but there are some folks who would prefer that I not have those conversations. But I feel responsible as a black person to force those conversations if necessary.
All right, Deb, you've been the pastor at the Church of the Messiah for a number of years. How diverse is your congregation, and how often does the topic of diversity come up?
The congregation in terms of racially is not very diverse, and that's been true with probably half the congregations that I've served. And the topic, I would say the topic comes up more when we're talking in terms of outreach ministries, and also in terms of trying to see ourselves in terms of what in terms of being an inclusive community. Not necessarily, I mean, obviously in terms of race, the racial relations, but and people of color coming, but also. Are there things that we are doing that are somehow excluding people? Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm very mindful of. And also, Will and I actually just did a, when we did Lessons and Carols, we wanted to do, which we did on Sunday, a joint service. We wanted to make sure that we had, for the offering, we wanted to do something that was justice-oriented. And it ended up giving some the offering to a program in St. Stephen's in Boston that deals with gun violence in a very in a diverse community. So it was a way of reaching out that way.
Yeah. And we're talking most about racial diversity here, but also economic diversity. Do we see economic diversity in your congregations? Everybody's kind of nodding. Yeah, some.
Yes, I think that's what we would. And that's, as I said, that's been true in other congregations that I've, and educationally too. I think that's another piece.
Right. So as faith leaders, and Ken, you might want to chime in here too. How often do you bring up issues affecting? You mentioned black community, but what about Latino and other like non-white communities? How often do you feel that you need to have these conversations with your congregation?
Yes, I regularly.
Regularly,
and we are planning already for 2020, and we're going to focus on indigenous peoples because of the whole Plymouth 400.
Right.
We want to make sure that the full story is told and the story that, especially the stories that get left behind sometimes and talk about the legacies of the invasion into our country and the whole transatlantic slave trade and what have you. So it's a regular I mean, I can't do it every Sunday because they'll tune me out. They won't listen to what I have to say. But frequently, especially when there are events going on nationally. That
warrant that kind of conversation.
Exactly.
Yeah, Ken, you want to chime in?
Yes, I'd like to follow up on that. Just recently, and in fact, this past Sunday, Nonset Interfaith had a service at dawn at First Encounter Beach in East Ham, which I was officiating at. And our desire was, this is in conjunction with the town of East Ham, 400th anniversary a year for the encounter between the English separatists and the native Nauset peoples, the indigenous peoples. And so I had a conversation with a representative of the Wampanoag tribe, and I realized in having that conversation that I had made assumptions that I should not have. Mm-hmm. And the young man I talked with, it was kind of tense at times, said, you know, we have to have clarity here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a lesson for me that I've had to learn over and over again, because being a white person living in a society in which whites just do what they want, mm-hmm. you don't realize, or often none of us do, or many of us don't, that we're falling into that trap again.
Yeah.
But we worked it out and made some changes, and the service was really powerfully moving, in which we had sort of equal time and a sharing of perspectives. And so I think that was a lesson for all of us.
Kind of a teaching moment,
It was a teaching moment for all of us. And we're looking forward throughout the year, and also working with the town of East Ham, which I think is another thing that faith communities, besides working with each other on issues of substance, not just, the tokenism, but also with other parts of the communities for the common good.
Yeah.
This, I think, is critically important for the future of faith congregations here in the Cape and elsewhere.
Yeah. Kristen?
I wanted to say that in our congregation, we probably don't go more than 2 weeks without talking about an issue that addresses marginalization. So for us, it's part of our faith. It's part of what we do. It's a core belief that we honor the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and justice, equity, and compassion in our human relations. So we're always connecting whatever it is we're talking about with issues that affect all marginalized communities.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to follow up on your question also, Mindy, about broadening the diversity and not just focusing on people of color. So at St. Barnabas in 2020, we've decided that because it's the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment that gave women the right to vote, we are going to, through the entire year, focus programming and preaching and teaching around those issues and inviting women to be more involved in what's happening in terms of leading worship services and preaching and what have you at St. Barnabas. So I'm always looking for ways to embrace diversity in its fullest.
Yeah, and there's a history there that a lot of people don't know. I mean, that was a long fought battle, obviously. But I'm thinking, even when you're talking about, you know, the history of the Wampanoag people, Native people of the entire country for that matter, we have a lot of revisionist history. And so when you're kind of, as you say, telling, you know, some facts that people may not have heard before, do you get pushback from your congregation, or are they more like, wow, I didn't know that, and thanks for educating me?
Well, you get that. Yeah, you get that. But yeah, they're more often not saying anything to me, but they'll talk to other people mm-hmm. and say, I don't know if I agree with what Will was saying. I don't know if Will knew what he was talking about when he said that. So it comes to me in a roundabout kind of way.
Yeah. Well, the other is Falmouth is reading the Mayflower for the town read, and it's I was just
eye-opening. Yeah,
absolutely. I was listening to it the other day on an audiobook, and just people decide. I mean, decide if the pilgrims deciding they could just go and ransack corn because they found it, and I continue to be astounded of the history that I don't know. Mm-hmm. The way in which I've been, and I had a quote, a very good education, but it's a very limited side.
Right.
And so it's trying to educate myself and also open up opportunities. I mean, where the question of inclusion and diversity has come up for us as a congregation has been, and actually something we've done across the faith communities, is around immigration issues.
Mm-hmm.
That's been an opening of a door of cooperation and of education of ourselves.
Yeah. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about the importance of diversity in faith communities and how we can make congregations more welcoming. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. In studio with us is Reverend Kristen Harper, pastor of the Unitarian Church of Barnstable, Reverend Will Mebben from St. Barnabas Church, Reverend Deb Warner from Church of the Messiah, and on the phone is Reverend Ken Campbell, convener of the Nauset Interfaith Association. So the Pew Research data that we mentioned says there are some diverse faith communities such as Seventh-day Adventists and Jehovah's Witness. What are your thoughts as to why some religious groups tend to be more diverse than others? Any thoughts on that?
That I don't know the answer to that. I would say, though, that all faith traditions need to be intentional, first of all, about examining their histories, and particularly their histories regarding the transatlantic slave trade and the legacies that remain there. Mm-hmm. And so some denominations maybe have done a better job at that mm-hmm. than others. Mm-hmm. I know here in the Episcopal mm-hmm. Church, there has been more intention around that, to ask parishes to examine their individual histories. What was your parish's connection to the slave trade? And we've been discovering, especially here in New England, that many of the Episcopal churches were built literally on the backs of slaves, and the wealth that accumulated within the Episcopal churches comes out of the slave trade. And there are churches now that are beginning to have discussions about, so how do we reconcile that? What can we do to repair that breach? Mm-hmm. Is it reparations in some form or another? And I heard some congregations talking about that just recently. But I would also say, Mindy, that churches have to be willing to do what Kristen's church did and what St. Barnabas did, and that is to bring in people of color in the leadership position, in the senior pastor, senior minister position. I am just the sixth person of color in the 235-year history of the Episcopal Church in Massachusetts to lead a predominantly white congregation. And there are 180 parishes in the Episcopal diocese. I'm the sixth in 235 years to be given that privilege, that opportunity. That speaks volume. You want black folks and brown folks and Latino and Latina folks to come to your congregations, you got to put them in the leadership positions.
Yeah. You know, and you're talking, too, about knowing the history. And I'm wondering, Kristen, we sort of talked about this earlier off the air, is there sort of some white people have that sort of guilt? And so it makes these conversations difficult because they're like, wow, you know, my ancestors were part of this. And, you know, and that kind of guilt sometimes puts up a wall, right, to have some of these conversations. Is that what you find in your congregation?
Yeah. Well, I think it's guilt, but I also think...
I'll wait.
I think it's guilt, but I also think it's guilt about what has happened and guilt about what is going on that they might not recognize that they're doing and seeing. And so they know they are not recognizing often what they're doing and seeing. And they make mistakes and think they're mistakes that can't be changed or corrected or forgiven. And I had an incident once where someone came up to me and thought I was somebody else. And as soon as I said, that's not who I am, she turned away and started walking away. And I said, wait, you know, this is who I am. I'm Kristen Harper. And just look at me. It's okay. You know, and I think some of it is that we're not willing to stay in the conversation and talk because it's uncomfortable.
It's uncomfortable, right?
And it makes us feel like somehow we are wrong. And it's not about wrong and bad. It's about being faithful and caring and building relationships. And building relationships are never easy.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ken.
Yeah. I was thinking of, you know, you shall know the truth and it shall make you free. And I was thinking of James Baldwin when he said, nothing can be changed until it is faced.
Yes.
And but if it is faced, it is liberating. It's not easy, but it's liberating. And if I can give another example, the Nauset Interfaith, one of the things we did this fall was to co-sponsor with another organization, which I think is also important, the Triangle Trade, a story of the Deep North, which I'm sure the clergy there all are familiar with, about the DeWolf family in Rhode Island, who made a fortune on the slave trade. And everybody in the town was involved in one way or another. And by extension, we also had a program on Cape Cod sea captains in the 18th and 19th century with a scholar, Matt O'Hilly. And people were, as several of you have said, were shocked when they heard these stories, and yet, in a sense, not shocked. But one of the good things, I think, that has come out of it is addressing, for instance, local historical societies and seeking to correct the record. And I think this is part of the amazing expansion of books, films, the arts, rising up from minority peoples that are helping to correct the historical record and show what really was, so that we can all own it together and grow together.
It's also it raises a question in terms of conversation. How do we do this? Because I would imagine, and this is maybe a projection, but if I were a person of color, to not be seen as a person of color is to just become invisible. And so the that happening over and over and over and over and over again, the outrage mm-hmm. and the hurt. And yet, so that's one piece of it. And then another side is how to, I don't know how that you temper that.
Mm.
To have, how a person of color tempers that in order to invite the conversation to go deeper. I don't know how
that's. You're bringing up a really good point.
It's like a gentleness piece, or kindness.
We actually did a program on the sort of microaggressions, and somebody would say, like Kristen, we said somebody mistook you for somebody else. Now, if that happens to you all the time, you're thinking, you start to get a little bit upset about that, right? And somebody says, well, she's overreacting, because they don't understand this is happening to you all. This isn't just one time that's happened to you in 6 years or something. This is happening on a regular basis. So I think, as white people, mm-hmm. perhaps it's, on us to maybe think about what that is like in that other person's shoes and why they're reacting the way they are. It's not necessarily because I just mistook you for somebody else. It's much deeper than that. It's the experiences that you've had before that you're reacting to, right? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I think the piece that Deb brought up is not that we want to be seen solely as people of color either, is we want to be seen as people. And the invisibility happens because of the color. And so people don't see us at all and often. And we're dismissed in lines. People step in front of us as if we're not there. People think we're somebody else. And so, yes, there can be anger with that. But I also think that if people stick with it, it's not, we can't always be kind.
Mm-hmm. No.
Right, no, right.
And so sometimes, and we can be kind in our anger too. I mean, I distinguish kind from nice.
Mm-hmm.
And kind to me is the willingness to stay in relationship mm-hmm. And stay in it and not be abusive.
Right.
But if someone, when people step in front of me, which happens all the time, in lines at stores, at convenience stores, whatever, I immediately feel invisible. And then I say, hello, I'm here. and sometimes it's nicely and sometimes it's not as nice. But it's always with the effort to say, you just totally dismissed my being.
Right. Yeah. I think you made a good point about nice versus kind. It's not that you're going to be mean.
Right.
It's just that you're not going to say, oh, that's okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And exactly.
Stand up and say something. Yeah. Go ahead.
So I want people to see my blackness. I want them to see me as a black person. If you say to me, and people often do it, and I believe they mean no harm, but people say, oh, I don't see color. Mm. Well, if you don't see color, you don't see me because I'm black. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's one thing. In the conversation that you were having just with Kristen, I was reminded we had a fire alarm go off at St. Barnabas, and you know the trucks rolled down and everything, and it was about 11:30 midnight, and I went to check on what was happening, and the firefighter said, "Oh, you're the caretaker." Can you say, well, yes, I am the caretaker. I take care of the souls of the people here at St. Barnabas. Yeah. But the immediate assumption was, you know, that I was custodian, janitor, what have you there. And one of the reasons I wear my collar around town so much is because people, it's part of my identity. And people aren't used to seeing a black man walking around town with a collar on representing the Episcopal Church. Mm-hmm. And it helps then move the congregation, move the conversation beyond to another level.
Yeah. You know, Chris, you had a conversation last week and, you know, talking about unconscious bias you just this group. And you talked about that and you asked anyone if they had ever mistaken a person of color, like Will's just talking about, are you the caretaker? What kind of answers did you get to that? How do white people respond to that question? And does it help generate the discussion about unconscious bias?
Well, the first question that I asked was actually, when did you first know you were white? And I think that's an opening question because for a lot of white people, they never think about when being white or knowing that they're white, because in this country, it's everyone and then the people of color. Mm-hmm. And whiteness is a group thing, and we're individuals. So I asked that question first, and then I asked about, you know, when did you mistake somebody? And I think it's an interesting conversation. Once one person was able to share, other people are able to share. And so, and to remember when they did it and not feel as guilty. Mm-hmm. And I think that because we all do it.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, all white people are doing that. And once they recognize that it's something that they don't have to beat themselves up for, but it's something that they are embarrassed about, and they can share that.
And I think people would be, and not just white people, I think all people would be surprised about the unconscious bias that they have.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, there's a website, I can't remember it off the top of my head right now, that you can go and take this test. And I think people would be really surprised at some of the bias that they don't think they have, right?
Right.
Ken, did you want to chime in?
Just to add that I had the experience when I was a young man of having a friend who was African American, and he took me to his church, which was overwhelmingly black. There were just a handful of white people there. And that, for me, I think, was the real moment when I recognized that I was white. Mm-hmm. I don't know why it hit me at that time, because it was a faith community, perhaps. And it makes me think of Baldwin again, in his writing. He spoke about, in addressing the white community, he said, "I know more about you than you know about me."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that this is a moment of revelation for all of us who are white in different ways, when we realize that is true.
Mm-hmm.
For in so many different ways in daily life. But again, for me, it was the beginning of my liberation, my being able to see more clearly what the world was like, and therefore to help others to do the same thing.
Yeah.
It has a, you know, as Chris has been saying, all of you have been saying, this is a work that will help all of us to become a better people and a single community united. That's our goal.
and say, we reached out to a church that has a predominantly black congregation, but we didn't hear back. So I'm not sure if anyone here knows the answers to this question, but do we have a sense if African-American congregations are interested in attracting more white congregants? Anybody have a thought on that?
I looked into the research on that, and I think it's called Lifeway Research in Tennessee, a Christian research company, talked about that about 51% of African-American churchgoers say that they're interested in having more diversity in their congregations, whereas in for white congregations, it's only about 37%.
Mm. Interesting. Mm. Yeah. Oh, it's funny because I was thinking when I saw that question, when was the first time you realized you were white? For me, it was as a child. I had my friend Ramona was my best friend, and we had such a hard time understanding why, you know, there was, you know, my grandmother didn't like that I had this black friend, and I couldn't understand that at all. And, you know, her sister, when I'd go over, her sister would say, why is your skin white and ours is brown? And, you know, we were just kids. And so I remember it being a very confusing time as a kid going, well, you know, what's the big deal, right? But, you know, this was in 1960s. So that was, you know, yeah, go ahead, Bob.
So this whole question about the segregation of congregations, I think is related to the fact that most churchgoers invite people to church from their social circles, from their families, from their professional circles. So if your social circle is exclusively one color or the other, if it's exclusively white, you're not likely to invite a black person to come to church with you. If all of your, or most of your experience in the world each day is dealing with people from your race, you're not likely to invite someone from another race to come and join you in church. And I think that's one of the reasons we've had this perpetuation of the segregation of congregations. Mm-hmm. Now, I was born and raised in the South and raised in the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, predominantly black denomination. But, you know, black folk have always been welcoming of white folk to come in. It hasn't always been that way, other way,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so
amen.
I just think that's a reality that still exists.
So, as we mentioned, we live in this area that lacks diversity. According to the 2000 census, Barnstable County is 90% white, almost 3% Latino, and 2.5% African-American. So this is that larger question that goes beyond faith communities, but how do we address diversity in a community that lacks diversity?
I think if I could add that part of it is the economic situation in our country, and particularly here on Cape Cod, where, as we know, we're losing young people because they can no longer afford to live here. Mm-hmm. And finally, you know, the 15 towns of Cape Cod have recognized the crisis in affordable housing. And we could all tell stories of trying to help people to be able to stay here, the large percentage of those who leave are younger people, and so we're faced with the threat of becoming a totally retired community. In fact, people say that Orleans is now, the average age of its inhabitants is the second oldest in the United States. Mm-hmm. So this is not good. I think it is good that towns and faith community members are trying to find ways of addressing the economic situation as well for housing. I know my own church, the Church of the Holy Spirit in New Orleans, back in the 60s, when the Johnson administration introduced the federal housing program, put up money for Tauntead Woods in Orleans, and that was an important step in beginning to move toward the opportunity for our residents to have a place that they could afford to live in their local area. So that's, I think, related to the separation that occurs, the housing and other costs of living on the Cape.
Go ahead, Deb.
Well, I think I think part of it's a question of how do we define diversity,
mm-hmm.
too.
Okay.
I mean, it's not just about racial diversity,
right.
As important as
right.
that is.
Yeah.
It's but what are the other components that we can look at in terms of diversity? And I think that, you know, there's the economic, obviously. As I said, I think in terms of educational, the age, gender, gender identification. There's obviously, I mean, this is one of the things that's been very interesting for pastors during this present administration in terms of the government, in terms of the political change, the political diversity or not in congregations. So I think that that's a part of the conversation to broaden the definition of diversity.
Yeah, and also as you're mentioning, trying to be inclusive of everyone.
Right.
Go ahead, Kristen.
I think it's true that broadening the definition of diversity is important, but it's also true the way we treat people who are already here matters. Mm-hmm. And if we're not treating people of color or different racial backgrounds well, then they're not going to stay.
That's right. Yeah.
And there, you know, one of the things I always talk about in my congregation is when I first came, I went down into the children and youth space, and there was a Bernard Hoyes print on the wall, and Bernard Hoyes is a Jamaican artist who paints about his female line's religious experience, and there were black angels and then a Native American dream catcher on the ceiling, and there were posters of Latino and Latinos, and there were Asian books, and there was just this diversity that was celebrated in that space, and I knew that my diversity was going to be welcomed. Mm-hmm. And we don't do enough to say diversity is welcome here.
Yeah, it's a good point. Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about the importance of diversity in faith communities. In studio with us is Reverend Kristen Harper, pastor of the Unitarian Church of Barnstable, Reverend Will Mebbin from the St. Barnabas Church, Reverend Deb Warner from Church of the Messiah, and on the phone is Reverend Ken Campbell. He's the convener of the Nauset Interfaith Association. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Laura Lee sends us a note. She says, good morning. Look at what they're doing in Richmond, Virginia. After a report on the benefits of removing huge statues in the city glorifying Confederate war figures proved inconclusive, the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts commissioned an even bigger statue of a black man on a black horse in a heroic posture by Kehinde Wiley. I hope I'm saying that right. Spectacular. Thanks for sharing that. So I guess that's the question that we look to is, let's talk about some of the things that we're trying to do with the faith community to kind of build these bridges that we can bring together. And I guess, Ken, since you're representing quite a few different, you know, what should we say, 22 different communities of faith, what are some of the barriers you're finding or challenges, and then some of maybe the benefits?
I think one of the challenges that we all face is and I don't mean this in a pejorative way, we're all Congregationalists in New England. I don't know about the rest of the country, in the sense that it's very easy to get wrapped up in your own little congregation. And there's much good there, you know, taking care of each other and learning together and praying together. But I think religion... at the heart of all our faith is to love, to reach out into the wider community, and sometimes to find God in that community or ahead of us, giving us new insights. It's an attitude, I guess, that I'm speaking about. But if our faith is liberating in our congregations, I think we need to do a much better job of getting involved in the broader community together and working with others for the common good, and that sometimes can be difficult. But you know, begin where you are.
Right.
Let me just give one illustration. As recently, we sponsored a pilgrimage to the new African American Museum of History and Culture in Washington, and we had 60 people. Go on a bus together, and it was a very mixed group of people from all different faith traditions, a significant number of minorities, and also We had people from 92 to 16, and several about it. We had a bunch of teens that went too. And I know if any of you have been, you probably have, to that museum. It is a powerful experience. And I think especially for white Americans, we need to start listening and learning from the experience of other minority groups to be healed of that racism that is in all of us who are white. So I think that that's one of the ways that we have found is good and is a blessing.
What about, I know there's, you know, a lot of the different faith leaders here meet kind of regularly, and there's some interfaith kinds of services and things that you do. So maybe talk a little bit about what we're doing, you know, with your churches, Deb and Will.
Well, what we're doing right coming forward is two things. One is that something's coming up, which is the Blue Christmas, which is actually going to be at Church of Messiah. And it's a Christian, it's based around a Christian model of Christmas is not necessarily the best time of the year or the most wonderful time of the year. And so it's coming together to acknowledge that across faith communities within the Christian church, and then also the Upper Faith Alliance is coming together to do a discussion about sanctuary, and that's Thursdays in January, beginning January 9th. So it's taking something that we hold in common, but looking at it through different lenses. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that that come to mind. Maybe Will has some other things that.
Well, I just think generally multi-faith and interfaith engagement is very important to me. And there's a history at St. Barnabas of wanting that sort of engagement as well. In fact, when the Falmouth Jewish congregation was without a facility, or was out without a place to worship, because if I'm remembering the story correctly, there was a fire that destroyed the synagogue. They held services at St. Barnabas. So, you know, we are open to that, and I'm open to bringing in religious leaders from other faith traditions, Muslim, Jewish, to preach and to teach in the congregation.
Yeah. What about you, Kristen?
Well, I'm in the Mid-Cape, so we have done stuff with St. Mary's, which is the other St. Mary's Episcopal Church, which is the other church in Barnstable, and we've done the Triangle Trade. We watched a movie together. We read the book together. We've had discussions on race together, and we've had, you know, interfaith services with the churches in the wider Barnstable town, and done standouts for immigration justice out front of the church with other churches and other people. So we like to have opportunities where we can get together with other people of different faiths and do justice endeavors in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we did the where the faith communities came together was the Anti-Semitism Act that was against the Jewish congregation in Falmouth. So that was another demonstration in terms of justice.
And around the climate crisis as well. We've come together. Yes.
Yeah. Now, Kristen, go ahead, Ken.
Just to add one other thing, this Nauset Interfaith is sponsoring a new round of studying Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham Jail, which we did a year ago, but with Chung Ho Park and the Cape Cod Symphony are going to give a word for us at their January concert, so that we can encourage more people to study that letter in groups, and we provide some assistance to do that. And the other thing is, on the issue of Israel and Palestine and the rise of white nationalism, we've got a group of people from Muslim, Jewish, and Christian who talk about ways we can talk about those issues and really hear each other and understand each other.
Yeah.
So those are two initiatives in the first half of 2020 that Nauset Interfaith will be addressing.
Now, Kristen, you've been administering to a predominantly white congregation for nearly two decades. What have changes have you seen maybe in yourself and in your congregation over that time period when it comes to talking about race and diversity?
I'm not sure if I've seen a lot of changes. I talk more probably about race and diversity than I ever have, because at the beginning I was not as confident in talking about it, because I didn't want to bring up an issue that might divide the church and have me kicked out before I got I was there for any time. So I definitely talk about race more often. I think people's understanding of the issues that I go through and other people of color go through is growing. We still have a long way to go. And I think that we go in cycles of talking about it and then it being quiet and then something happening and having to bring it up again. And so I think it's something we're always going to be dealing with.
Yeah.
Because it's something that I don't believe can be just healed and it's over with. I think we heal and then we go,
right.
you know, fall
yeah.
back, and then we heal and we fall
right.
back.
Yeah. We did have a caller who called in. Remember, I mentioned that quiz or something you can take about to see what your unconscious bias is, and it's projectimplicit@harvard.edu.
Yeah.
So do you find your congregants and your older and then your younger congregants have different views about diversity? Is it the same conversation?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, go ahead, Ken.
Just that in general, younger people are much more open because that's their life experience mm-hmm. today. Although there are some older people who are amazingly open. You know, I don't want to stereotype it, but generally it's the younger people who are leading here in so many ways. And I just might add that I think that all of the turmoil that we're going through really is an opportunity for us as Americans to do some maturing as a culture. It's scary, but it is, I think, an opportunity. The more we look into these things in the face, the more we will be able to understand and become more compassionate and mature
yeah.
as a people.
Go ahead, Will.
That's my hope.
So churches keep saying they want young people in their congregations, right? That millennials won't show up, right? And I think one of the reasons they don't show up is because we don't talk about the issues that are important to them. Mm-hmm. Preachers are not preaching about these issues. They're not preaching about sexism and misogyny and racism and all these issues. And so young people say, I'll stay on Facebook. I'll stay on social media. I have my conversations there. If we want young people in our pews, we have to start preaching the messages that they want to hear and need to hear.
I think it's also important that it's not just about people coming to us. I think it's incredibly important for the church and the faith communities to be about, to be visible in the communities in which we're serving, at least for the clergy, that it's not, and members as well.
Yeah.
So.
All right, Reverend Kristen Harper, pastor of the Unitarian Church of Barnstable, Reverend Will Mebbin from St. Barnabas Church, Reverend Deb Warner from Church of the Messiah, and Reverend Ken Campbell, convener of the Nauset Interfaith Association. Thank you all for being here. I really appreciate the conversation this morning. Hopefully we'll have you all back again sometime soon.
Thanks, Mindy.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy
Thank
Todd.
You.
Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.